This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, sorry to hear that your trial got canceled. You were supposed to be in trial today. What happened?
The Nevada Supreme Court stayed the case because the defense, candidly, I think they just want to delay the inevitable and filed writs and filed everything and asked for continuances, and this Hail Mary was granted. So it's delayed but not denied. So we'll be off to the races eventually.
So I think this is the first time we've been on air since you were formally admitted to the inner circle of advocates. I wanted to congratulate you publicly on that. It's a well-deserved, and I think you'll be very happy to be part of that. I think it's the best trial lawyer organization on the planet. Briggs can vouch for that as well, but it's great to have you and welcome aboard.
Thanks, Ben. From the outside looking in, I've always seen it as the best trial lawyer organization on the planet. I can't even believe I'm a part of it yet. It still hasn't hit me yet, but I'm just glad to be a part of it and glad to be with you, Briggs, and all the other amazing lawyers who are part of the inner circle.
Well, welcome and congratulations. I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person.
Likewise.
Hey, one more thing, Rahul. I don't know if this plays into stereotypes, but I was wondering about this whole cricket thing. Are you a cricket fan?
You know what? My father-in-law is a big cricket fan. I think who just won? Was it
India?
They did?
They beat Pakistan in the World Cricket Championships, which I'm thinking I might switch over to cricket from football because I'm a little down on football as a New England fan. And I don't know, but I don't really understand cricket. I was hoping you could explain it to us.
Nope. The most cricket I've gotten is that movie King Ralph with John Goodman. And I don't think that's quite a accurate representation of the real game of cricket, but it seems to be really popular. I highly recommend it.
I mean, about 10 times more people watch that World Cricket Championship than watch the Super Bowl. It's kind of amazing.
Oh, that's staggering.
Yeah. So we'd like to welcome to the podcast today Briggs Bedigian and John Stefanuca. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So now, Briggs, you guys were for a long time based out of Maryland, but recently you moved to Philadelphia. So your firm is it still centered in Maryland with a branch in Pennsylvania? Are you guys?
That's exactly right. You know, we've always kind of been a regional firm with our hub in Maryland. But because of the proximity of Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., we're able to kind of spread out. We're very centrally located in just north of Baltimore City. So you know, that's where the hub is. We have an office in Philadelphia as well. And I'm up there most of the time now. We're all over the place. You guys know how it is. You got to somewhere where you're not supposed to be or somewhere that you need to get to.
So one of the interesting themes we've discovered on this podcast recently is that many of the best trial lawyers around the country originated from the state of Maine.
That's right.
We just had Christian Morris on from Nevada, and she grew up in Maine. I don't know if you know Christian, but she was the trial lawyer of the year a year or two ago in the state of Nevada, grew up in Franklin County, Maine. So Briggs, you're also from Maine.
I am.
How did you end up from those humble beginnings in the poor and out of the way state of Maine becoming the amazing trial lawyer that you are?
Well, I had wonderful parents. I grew up on an island off the coast of Maine. My parents were hippies that were very into the outdoors and very into science and nature and just very compassionate people and wonderful parents. And after I was raised there, went to college in upstate New York. And from there, when I graduated, I had nowhere to live and no money and no job.
By the way, so our viewers understand, you were a football star and were actually All-American football player in college, right?
Yeah, but I had my hand in the dirt. I was an offensive lineman, so, you know.
You don't seem big enough to be an offensive lineman.
So, my hand, I like the dirty work, you know, get down there in the trenches.
It's amazing now, though, what the premium on offensive linemen are. Like, they're the second highest paid position players in the NFL, right? So obviously they do something that's important.
The left tackle is a cornerback, a quarterback. It's been amazing, the evolution with the passing offenses. After Ithaca, I went to just came down to the Washington, D.C. area, worked construction for a year, got in-state residency, and started law school. Met my wife the first day of law school, and I've been being told what to do ever since.
She's a lawyer?
She is. Well, right now she's doing the hardest job in the world and raising three kids who are all in. We have one in lower school, one in middle school, one in high school. So it is a tough job. So she makes it easy for me.
And how about you, John? What's your life story, so to speak?
This is a good one. This is fascinating.
No, I wish I were from Maine as well, but fortunately, I grew up in Eastern Europe, moved here when I was almost 20, went to college here in Maryland, and after college, it seemed like a natural progression to go to law school here, and the rest is history. But I grew up in a tiny little country in Eastern Europe called Moldova. We are also known for our lawyers and our wine.
How did you guys meet up?
How did we meet up? That's interesting. I was with another law firm here in Baltimore, and one day I was driving to work thinking to myself, how much I hate looking for other jobs. And half an hour later, Charles Gilman, our partner, called and said, hey, would you be interested in talking to us about coming here? I said, funny you should ask. And the rest, again, is history.
John's coming up on 10 years.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. I got to tell you, John and I tell this, we say this to each other all the time, but I've practiced law with a lot of people and had co-chairs, but the two of us have a lot of fun together. So I have never had more fun practicing law. Because there's a good yin and yang. When I'm down, he's up. The only problem with John is he is incredibly, incredibly cranky in the mornings. Like, so much, I won't even talk to him. Can't talk to him until about 9:30.
Oh, shoot. It's 9:12 right now.
Yeah. We should have mentioned that before we scheduled the morning recording of the show.
He'll be on his best behavior, I'm sure.
My third cup of coffee already.
It's 6:12 a.m. for Rahul.
Oh, my. That's right.
No.
That's dedication.
All right. Halfway through the day.
Did you guys both know you always wanted to be trial lawyers? Or how did you come to this job, career?
I'll let Briggs go first on this one.
The short answer would be yes. I always kind of had an inkling that I wanted to practice law. I didn't know kind of in what areas. First, I wanted to save the world and be an environmental lawyer. As I slowly got into the progression of law school and then the experiences of working out there, I found out what I didn't like to do and what I really like to do. And what I really like to do was be on my feet, trying cases in front of judges and juries and, you know, having that anxiety and the stress and the butterflies and all the good things that come with competition. And I really liked it. So from there on, I was hooked and just started to develop a practice where I could get into the courtroom as much as possible and take some swings. And I've tried to impart that attitude on all the guys and young ladies that work for us and how I always kind of saw it. And then I just kind of fit what I was good at. I wasn't good sitting behind a computer and writing emails all day and insurance blogs or, you know, insurance reports and anything like that. So I came over to this side and just I've loved it ever since.
Yeah. My story is a little bit different. Elementary school, I somehow accidentally ended up on the debate team trying to do a favor for a relative and realized quickly I'm not that bad at it.
What was the issue?
Christ, I don't remember this. It was some policy regarding feeding the world and solving world hunger. And I knew nothing about the format. I was thrown into it. And I think I was in sixth grade. And before I knew it, I'm in the semifinals, then finals. And then I'm getting my first trophy. And I got a little taste for victory. And before I knew it, I was coming to Maryland on a debate scholarship here at Towson University. And So advocacy came always naturally to me. My parents pushed me to go to medical school. They're both physicians. They were terribly disappointed.
But at least now you're suing doctors, so.
Right. And they're the ones that consult on a regular basis as to, well, tell me about this lab and tell me about this lab. So they've gotten over it.
Do you guys have different roles when you try cases together? How do you divide up the responsibilities?
We really don't. I think it's very fluid and dynamic. And like Briggs said, he will hate to admit it, but we are kindred spirits. And oftentimes we won't know who will do what until the very last minute. And it tends to be organic. Sometimes we'll even plan ahead of time that he'll do X, Y, and Z, and I'll do something else. And we will completely switch it right before it happens. And it happens all the time. And it's fluid and it's natural. Neither one of us rehearses. Neither one of us reads notes and openings or closings. Neither one of us uses an outline for crosses or directs. We tend to stand up and do our thing. So we can switch gears quickly that way. I think that's a pretty fair characterization. Don't you think, Briggs?
I would. Yeah, it's like my whole thing is, and what we've always talked about is, I don't think a jury should hear from one voice and a predominantly one voice. And that's a complete shift from, you know, the way I was taught and the way I first started practicing. And once I started doing it and other voices coming in, I mean, it's a pleasure to try cases with other good lawyers who understand the theme and understand that what they need to get out of every witness. So I think it's been, we're very fluid like that and just, you know what we're going to do. And just the problem is, you know, one of us will be like, look, I want this guy today. Like, I read this deposition last night. I'm going to take this. I'm taking him on cross today. And we're good about it. We're like, all right, he's yours. Go get him, Tiger.
It piqued my interest here. So cross-examination with zero notes. I can't even wrap my head around this. So how does that happen?
I was going to ask about that too.
Some people write their outlines of the crosses. You've got to be able to react on the spot. You all know that, you know, and what you expect is going to be the script is almost never the script. And so, you know, Briggs can speak to his methodology more than I can, but, you know, the way that I approach this, I have themes that I want to hit, and I don't have them in any particular order. So I do have a list of themes. I don't have questions. And oftentimes, the questions just naturally evolve during the conversation. I don't know how to do it otherwise. I find it that if you over-prepare and script what you're going to say, and I learned this from Briggs, actually, it doesn't come out naturally. It's not conversational. It seems rehearsed. It seems stagnant and rigid. And jurors are much more interested in hearing a dynamic conversation that appears to be unpredictable than something that appears to follow a script.
Now, when you say unpredictable, is it unpredictable in that you don't know what the witness is going to say, or unpredictable in just sort of which direction you want to go with the conversation?
Mostly the latter. Obviously, you know, the old rule of don't ask questions to which you don't know the answer. I don't know that it applies with regularity. I think we often ask questions where we take a risk not knowing what the answer is going to be. But that's such is the nature of the beast. That's what makes it interesting. You have to be willing to appear like you're open-minded and not biased, even as a cross-examiner.
And I'll tell you, the other thing that we've done that's, I think, really kind of revolutionized our practice and allowed us to handle, you know, have more bandwidth, so to speak, is we've stopped taking expert depositions. We're in a state in Maryland and D.C. where expert depositions are allowed, okay? Unfortunately, there's no limit on the number of experts. Expert discovery becomes extremely burdensome. So we have stopped deposing defense experts in jurisdictions we're allowed to under the guise of let them prep all six OBs that they've named. Let them go through and have to get them for trial, not knowing exactly what our themes are going to be. I think when you cross-examine these guys in deposition and you give them a roadmap, all you're doing is prepping them for the defense, and they're going to look and they're window dressing. They're going to say, all right, which one of my guys held up the best? Which one looked the best? Which one's the best counterbalance to John or Briggs? And then they pick and choose accordingly. I just think you don't give them the dress rehearsal. I mean, if you don't know what you're going to talk about and what you're going to ask, and you can't figure out what the experts are going to say, it's pretty easy. You know, they're going to say, we didn't do anything wrong. Even if we did do something wrong, we didn't cause anything. And even if we did do something wrong and we did cause something, it's a patient's fault. You know, so, and what John always says, and it's very true about this, is the most important and critical thing in a medical malpractice case is the deposition of the defendant, the bad actor, the wrongdoer, or whatever variation of how many there are, okay? Because once you pin them down, you know, and John's excellent at this because he's more scientist than lawyer sometimes. But once you pin that defendant down, the experts can't stray far away because the greatest cross-examination is, so you disagree with the defendant. I think that's been kind of what we do. Focus, focus, focus on the defendant's depositions, the fact witnesses. Every one of them are videotaped. We do not videotape any of our experts or anything like that, but we videotape all fact witnesses because now with the technology the way it is and the use of video clips at trial and how everything has advanced since COVID, I mean, that becomes powerful evidence. And when you play the snippets of, you know, it's not just the words, but you see their body language and you see the frustration and you see them look at their lawyer over there saying, help me, these eyes of desperation that you just don't get from reading a transcript, you know? So we've really focused more organically on the fact stuff, figuring out, I mean, most of the stuff we handle is pretty similar. So we know the medicine and, you know, we're able to not have to have that level of breakdown in notes and things of that nature.
I hate to say it, if no matter how good you are in the medicine, if you're going to try a medical malpractice case just on the medicine and medicine alone, I'm not saying medicine is not important. It's the centerpiece of a medical malpractice case. But if you try it just on the medicine, the odds are you're going to lose the case. And it's got to be more than just about the medicine. And like, we go out of our way to make sure that there's a larger context of the case every time we go to trial.
For example?
Some people call it moral truths, right? Some people call it moral framing, whatever you want to call it. I think you're looking for the larger theme, you know. And oftentimes it's inherently back to the case. You know, there's a element of unfairness in life, a single mother with a kid trying to raise a child, where, you know, the burdens of someone else's mistake is squarely on their shoulders with no responsibility on a healthcare provider. Sometimes it's the palpable unfairness that comes out of the way that the defense lawyer litigates the case. In which case, I will not hesitate, Briggs will not hesitate to make the case as much about the lawyers as about the defendants. So you make it about a larger theme that transcends just that one individual client. It's not easy to do. You have to do it with taste and finesse, but you can do it. And that gives the jury motivation to go the plaintiff's way when there is an inherent bias towards the healthcare provider.
I'm really intrigued by your approach of not doing expert depositions or using outlines or notes in your crosses. As someone who does a lot of medical malpractice cases myself, I've done it both ways with jurisdictions where they don't allow depositions, been forced to do the trial cross without the safety net of the prior deposition. It's scary because you don't have that safety net underneath you. And sometimes things can get away from you where you get into an area of medicine or there's an opinion that you weren't anticipating. You can't really go toe-to-toe on the medicine because you're not prepared on the point. How do you guys deal with that? Do you just bring it back to your core themes, or do you have some kind of backstop you can fall back on if things start to go south on an expert cross where you don't have that backstop of a deposition?
Your broader question there, or theme really, what you're asking is the safety net of a deposition, sure, that's there because you've pinned every down. You know what they're going to say and you have cross-examination material. But it also comes with a con of you're prepping them for your cross-examination, your theme. And no matter how a defense lawyer looks at the case, they're never going to look at it as a plaintiff lawyer looks at the case. So I think there's pros and cons to both. We've decided in our practice that the pros of not deposing them outweigh the cons. And part of that, Ben, is we have a little bit of a luxury of we try a lot of birth injury cases. Okay. And we know the medicine in the birth injury cases. I've tried, I think, close to 30 birth injury trials. And when you have that level of familiarity, you can keep the expert reined in. And when they go off, you can break it down into more simple themes. But we have the luxury of kind of the medicine, really in our cases, it's only the faces that change, the faces of the defendants, the faces of the plaintiffs. The defense lawyers all look the same. And the defense experts all look the same. And they're all going to do the same thing. Yeah. So it's one of those things where it's, you know, pros and cons to every approach.
How does that approach help or hurt if in cases that don't go to trial, that go towards settlement, if the defense doesn't appreciate sort of all aspects of why you're going to win this case and need to pay?
But they do. They do, because, and I go back to what Briggs was saying, I think the most important thing we do in these medical malpractice cases is the fact witness depositions. The main defendant deposition is by far the single most important thing that we do. And, you know, some people treat these discovery depositions as just a discovery deposition. It's not. You have to think about causation. You have to think about damages. And you bring that up in those depositions. I'm going to give you an example. I don't know how many lawyers ask this, but I do routinely. I cross the OB in the deposition to exclude, pre-existing conditions and antecedent events right there and there. Let their experts then tell me there's placental insufficiency or intrauterine growth restriction or whatever else that they come up with in response to litigation. I shut that down with the defendant. And the other thing is, we work our cases up in great detail before we file them. So I know what the issues are going to be when we get into litigation. And then if I need to foreclose issues, I will not stop with the defendant. I will often depose the NICU providers that diagnose the HIE.
And corporate designees.
And corporate designees. So
it's huge in today's electronic medical record world. The doctor by committee, you know, you no longer have the quarterback, the attending physician who's overseeing everything. It's all this doctor by committee, whatever hospitalist is on shift kind of thing.
They know what the issues are before, when we go into mediation or think about resolution of the case. And frankly, I really don't think that it matters to them. You can tell them they're in trouble. If they don't want to sell cases, they don't. I mean, maybe it does to a certain degree, but them not knowing where we're coming from and what their weaknesses are.
Go back to your initial question. I think that's a luxury. Let them underestimate your case. Let them oversell it to their risk managers and to the insurance adjusters, and let them come in and say, oh yeah, we've got this in the bag. And all of a sudden they see, you know, the wheels just came off the bus because you hit something from an angle they never expected because you didn't broadcast it beforehand. I think, look, the strategies, you know, everything's different for everybody. People have different comfort levels. Like, you know, some people need to have the notes there. They need to write it out. That's how their mind works. It's how it absorbs things. We just are not like that. There's probably a lot of faults to that too. And I'm not saying we don't miss things. And for us, it works. And, you know, I think what John said earlier.
Your verdicts don't suggest there's a problem with it at all. So it's like a consistent, massive track record.
I was going to say, I mean, the results speak for themselves.
Yeah.
I think just last year, you guys had back-to-back verdicts of, what, $34 million in Maryland and $191 million, or maybe it was more than that, even in Philadelphia, and two difficult birth injury trials.
You know what they say, it's a clean shirt and a smile, and it's always better to be lucky than good, right? No, the verdict in Pennsylvania was, actually, we did the math wrong because it was a very detailed verdict sheet. It went out like 5 pages of years. And we did the math wrong, quite frankly. It was 182.7. So the false advertising at 191, I just want to make sure I don't get it, you know, accused of blustering.
Hey, Ben, we invited these guys because we thought it was 191, not 183, right?
Yeah, we might have to rescind the invitation now.
Those were two cases that probably should have settled. And for differing reasons in both cases, they went to trial. And a lot of those times, a trial, I always put akin to like a, not to be cliche with the football analogy, but you never know how the ball is going to bounce. Okay. In every game, no matter how it looks on paper, there's going to be a fumble and that ball is going to take a weird bounce somewhere, somehow. And some days it bounces into your hands and some days it bounces into your opponent's hands. It's just one of those things where you just have to you see it through. It will usually work out.
The man is being humble. Okay. His results are the result of very hard work and tremendous imagination in how you try a case and having the courage to say no to a lot of money and go in there and do what you think is best for your client. That's what he did. But no, you can be humble for now. You can say the humble stuff. I'll say the truth.
Well, you're being humble too, John, since you were a big part of that, right?
Well, you know, the Philadelphia verdict, I was sort of the third wheel, right? I was helping from the background. Some work on causation in that case and help prep witnesses and whatnot. But, you know, all the credit goes to my partners, Merritt and Briggs, in that case. It was a hard-fought case, and it was great lawyering. That's the reason the result is what it is.
Can you guys talk a little bit about how you structure your firm? Because to handle all of these complex birth injury cases, I know how much goes into that in terms of the outlay of the resources, the attorney time, and then to be able to line them up and try them kind of back to back. How do you manage the workflow in a way that allows you to handle these types of cases effectively and do the high level work that you're doing on them?
Nicotine and coffee.
There's folks other than the two of you, I'm assuming, that are...
Yeah, certainly. No, look, there's a ton of people behind the scenes. Our business partner, Charles, allows us to be the trial lawyers and completely runs the show from an operational standpoint. That's nice. The business of law is suffocating, okay? The practice of law is wonderful, right? But the business of law is tough, you know, when you've got employees and you've got 401ks and you've got insurance, you've got all the other things that come with it. So that's a really nice luxury to have. As far as the setup, John and I kind of run everything where we have teams. And what will happen is we don't do things by committee, meaning all of our lawyers don't get together and brainstorm cases, which we've done because more out of necessity than fun, because it's a great camaraderie. It's a great way to learn to brainstorm these cases. But what we've had to do for a matter of efficiency is narrow that down. So basically what happens is we've got three teams, okay? I jump in between all three teams. So John runs one team. That's the A team, let's say. Our partner Merritt up in Pennsylvania runs the Pennsylvania book of business, okay? The other A team. And then we've got another really good attorney that joined us a couple of years ago who I think has a ton of potential, but he's still got a lot to learn. He's got to get in there and get some trial experience, runs the other team, which I would say. And all I do is kind of we meet individually, like John and I meet, or Merritt and I meet. But John and Merritt don't ever talk about their cases in passing and fun, but they're not working. We don't have that overstep. And that way, you don't want too many chefs in the kitchen. You don't want to go to what the hospital's done and do this doctor by committee. You don't want lawyer by committee. You want one guy working up the case and another guy coming in and trying it with him. And what I do with my John is he has made my life so much easier. And all of the folks that we have because they're highly organized. John has a meticulous brain where everything is hyper-organized. Now, that's probably my greatest fault is disorganization. I'm ADHD all over the place, right? But having somebody that is behind the scenes that can organize everything and where I can go and just pick up a file and have everything at my fingertips and really absorb it in a very short amount of time because of the hyper-organization, that allows us to go cases where we're trying a three-week birth injury case, I get a week in between and I start another one. And the only reason is because Merritt and John are completely unlike me and have the case super organized, never have an issue with the paper. And then it's the trial that's fun. So that's a very long-winded way to say we do it in a team approach, but segregate the teams.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look. Steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
This is might be a heavy lift to ask, but I'm assuming we probably have quite a few listeners who dabble in medical malpractice cases. Occasionally, we'll see a birth injury case or may have one right now sitting on the corner of their desk. Can you guys, since you have so much experience managing these cases and trying them, can you give us the kind of 10,000-foot primer on how to do these cases, at least issue spot enough so that if you're one of those listeners, they know what to do next with their case, other than maybe just call you guys and ask for your help?
The problem that you have in birth injury cases is they are extremely, extremely hard-fought cases. And that means they're very expensive. And unless you have the resources to put finances aside and say, we can go toe-to-toe with the insurance company, you're going to really do your client a disservice because these cases, unfortunately, are all won on expert witnesses. And the more expensive, then the shinier your expert and the more persuasive they are, the more expensive they are. And, you know, I think a lot of people get into this and they think, oh, I'm going to get this birth injury case. I'm going to settle it. I'm going to make a lot of money. These things go on for years. They are fistfights. You have everything thrown at you. And sometimes you get a judge that gets some silly defense motion on an evidentiary issue. buys what they're selling in 3 years of hard work is up on appeal for 3 years. I mean, that's a tough way to go.
Yeah. If you're forced to litigate a case and you don't do this on a regular, I mean, there's no real right way to do it. Obviously, have your client's best interest in mind. But some suggestions come to mind right now. I mean, if you've got a good case, you're going to know from the beginning what your issues are. The first thing you need to do is to find somebody real good to be your main expert. Don't go crazy on the number of experts. Just find somebody. Don't just research somebody on one and use them as an expert. Get somebody with a reputation for being able to deliver and get that person as your expert. And then the other thing that I would suggest is don't go all crazy. Sometimes it helps you to play possum in litigation. Don't do discovery depositions of experts, because they're going to designate for every one of yours, they're going to designate three or four experts in each specialty. And I see people that don't do this all the time. Just go ahead and chase those people, do all these depositions, help them audition their experts, you know, dress rehearsal, as Briggs said. Don't do that. Know what your issues are up front by hiring a good guy, good expert. Then play jiu-jitsu. Keep it simple and let them be the proactive ones.
From a medical perspective, what you're really looking for in a malpractice case, like any personal injury case, is the damages drive the case, right? So the more catastrophically injured these poor souls are, the bigger the case is. And that becomes the way to judge it. You're looking first at, let's look at the child. Let's look at this baby. Let's see how they do. Let's see how their life is going to be forecast. And then you work backwards from there. So you can have a birth injury today with the advent of cooling, which is hypothermia treatment, where these kids who 10, 15 years ago would have been dead on arrival, okay, are not only alive, but flourishing. It's been a godsend to neonatal medicine. It's great for the human being. It's great for the human race. It sucks for the legal case, but that's wonderful. A lot of times you'll see this horrific injury at birth, and then you talk to the family 3 years later and you say, how's Junior doing? Like, well, he's excelling, he's running around, he's playing tag with his friends, he's speaking, he does the alphabet, he can say it backwards, you know, and you're like, well, that's wonderful, but there's no more case there. And you've spent a lot of resources because it takes time. Like, you can't file one of these cases until the kid's at least a year old, at least, because you have no idea where your damages are. Your experts can't assess them. So the problem with these cases and how they become all assuming is they're so expensive and you got to bring so many of them in. And then you're funneling all those and they take years. But the fundamental thing to look for is the damages first. And if the kid is and the child is touched, okay, you work backwards. And then you say, how did this happen? You know, they're going to look for every reason. When a child goes to the neonatology department from the OB department and is injured, the neonatologists are going to look for absolutely every possible explanation to explain that child's presentation, except one thing. They're going to completely not look at one thing. They're going to have blinders on. And that's, what did the physicians do that were behind me? They look at everything else, but they never look back at, did we screw this up?
Hell, even when they diagnose HIE, they try to refer to HIE in 10 different ways, but HIE. Okay, they'll call it encephalopathy to leave it ambiguous as to maybe it's infectious or something else.
Poor tone.
They'll talk about depressed at birth and never use encephalopathy. You know, they'll go out of their way not to use the magic words that in their mind would trigger liability. And
these guys are trained.
You know?
They're all trained. I mean, these risk managers know what they're doing. They know what these birth injury cases are. They know how to get everybody prepped for it and how to put up the iron curtain. I mean, that's why it's these things become so tedious of a fight is, you know, you're taking on very worthy opponents who are extremely well-funded and they want to make these cases as expensive as possible as a deterrent, just more tort reform. You know, you lose a couple cases where you got $500,000 invested in them, like, you know, all of a sudden that stings.
Can you guys talk a little bit about those two trials you did last year? Maybe tell us a little bit about the facts and then your approach to trying the case.
Sure. I'll tell you, John was the mastermind of the $34 million verdict in Baltimore County. It's the largest verdict, to our knowledge, in Baltimore County in medical malpractice. It was probably one of the most difficult birth injury cases from a medicine standpoint that we have ever tried, or I have ever tried, or I've seen be tried. It was, we were going up against a hospital system that we have a very adverse relationship with. And so it's all scorched earth. So we had, you know, teams of lawyers on the other side against us. But John was the mastermind of that case. So I will let him give you the short and sweet of it.
Well, multiple defense law firms involved in trying to defend that particular case. Now, that was a very interesting case. It was the reverse of your typical placental abruption case. Most people will argue, you know, failure to timely diagnose an abruption. And we argued the opposite. We argued that the physicians and nurses overreacted to diagnose a placental abruption without any concrete evidence of an abruption, thereby causing the child to be delivered with significant prematurity at 24 weeks. And then causation was easy because no one was disputing that the child's problems were the result of prematurity. And he had intracranial bleeds, he had hypoxic ischemic lesions, all of the most severe complications, that kind of prematurity. And I remember looking at the file, and Briggs said, "Are you nuts? You're going to argue the reverse of a placental abruption case?" I said, "Yes, I am." And then I took the defendant's deposition, and I was looking for that magic answer about, tell me why you thought it was an abruption. And we focused on pain and blood and hematocrit and hemoglobin and placental pathology, and none of it seemed to corroborate the diagnosis of placental abruption. And I said, "We've got to pull the trigger on this. This was an unnecessary delivery by C-section by a young physician who overreacted to something that he was not familiar with and relied on perfunctory information from the nurses about patients' complaints without ever looking at the fetal heart tracing, without ever looking at the tachometer tracing, and just rushed her into the main operating room and cut her open." And that's what happened. And like I said to you in the beginning, a lot of these cases are, you can't just litigate them on the medicine. It has to be about something more than that. In that particular case, it was about our good friends on the other side. They over-defended the case. They absolutely over-defended the case. They had multiple witnesses coming in with one single memory. They had no memory of anything else, but they had one memory of gushing, pouring blood for something like 20 minutes. I remember standing up and closing, and I said, "Look, you don't have to listen to their testimony. Look at the labs. Look at the hematocrit. Look at the hemoglobin. It hadn't changed pre and post op. Where's the blood? Where's this magical blood loss?" And then, of course, Briggs gets up in a rebuttal, and without telling me what he's going to do, picks up a pitcher of water and starts pouring to a cup that I cannot see. So I'm thinking it's pouring the water onto the well of the courtroom, and I'm waiting for the bailiff to arrest him. And he's sitting there pouring this water from a pitcher for something like 2 minutes as he's staring at his watch. And then he looks at him and says, "That's how long she's been bleeding at this rate, according to them. Why is she not dead?" I thought it was, by the way, Briggs, I thought it was well done. I wish you gave me the heads up so I wouldn't have panicked. But it was a complicated case and multiple fact witnesses. Placental pathology was tremendous. I'm a big fan of calling people back in rebuttal. I like to have the last word. We called our pathology expert from his lab at his hospital. He was wearing a hoodie covered in blood, and just listening to their pathologist for the first time because they didn't disclose anything he was going to say. And it was like, you know, I completely disagree, and just ripped them a new one right there and over Zoom and rebuttal. But let me tell you something interesting about this case. It's the only case I've ever had where the judge allowed the jurors to submit jury questions to the lawyers, not just at the end of the day or at the end of the witnesses cross or direct, but during. We had one juror who we were convinced was against us the entire time.
Well, he said as much.
Actually said it because we voir dired him at some point.
I kind of like the plaintiff's lawyers. They make me feel uncomfortable. I was like, "Oh, this is going well."
They're staring at him. He alone submitted during the course of our trial 184 questions. So you can imagine, you're in the middle of questioning a witness and all of a sudden the judge gets it, and now I've got to cater to this guy. Right. So eventually we decided not to entertain him and kind of focused on our themes and just addressed the questions that were important. But it was stressful because the danger, of course, was they have a question for you, don't address it. What do you got to hide? Right. I mean, that's sort of I wish the judge did it differently, but we had to live with that distraction for 2.5 weeks.
And I will say that was a wonderful judge, very fair judge to try the case against. The hardest thing about that case from a liability perspective is this young doctor. I mean, he was a baby doctor, right? He looked at that jury, you know, he said to them, he was like, "I thought it was an abruption. I thought I was doing this to save her life." That's a tough thing to overcome from a plaintiff's perspective when you have the burden of proof that this guy, okay, maybe he overreacted, but in his mind, he was going to save her life. And if the defense had pushed, I think, and focused on that and not fought us on all the periphery things so much where it just takes away from their credibility, they won't focus on the one thing that's good, they'll focus on all the other little things and nitpick it. It lowers their credibility. I think that was a fact that was like, when I heard it, it was like, ooh, that was a gut punch. I was like, that's a tough thing to overcome. And the way John did it and we did it was just showing all their credibility issues. They're challenging us on how long the kid's going to live. They're challenging us on how long the trach's going to stand. They're challenging us on everything. Everything was a fight. When you start picking on everything, they're going to start, well, maybe they plan to have something to talk about.
And there's something else, too, that helped overcome the issue that Briggs, obviously, that was one of our biggest concerns, the one that Briggs just brought up. But one of the things that made me want to take the case was the fact that all of the references to placental abruption were after the fact. So they diagnose it, and by the time they deliver, it's about a half an hour period. There's no contemporaneous record of anybody saying, we think it's an abruption, or bleeding, or anything like that. It's all after the fact. And it gets worse than that. Even the main surgeon, the operating surgeon, even when he places orders for placental pathology after the fact, there are fields for why you're doing it, what's the indication. And he doesn't talk about abruption. He talks about what he thought was preterm labor. And only after an hour and a half later, a senior provider in the hospital comes in and enters a redundant pathology requisition for him and changes that field, asking the placental pathology department to look for placental abruption. Somebody who wasn't in the operating room had nothing to do with that patient that day. And there are other pieces of evidence that were suggesting that this was sort of a after-the-fact thinking, that this was an abruption after the fact. And it looked like a cover-up. And that's what I think it really helped overcome this notion that we were just trying to save her life.
I will tell you something funny that you tell you about the defense lawyer in that case. Then they're closing, because John gave closing, I gave rebuttal. So in between, the defense lawyer gets up and does this whole thing with picking on the plaintiff kind of thing. And that just backfires every single time. They took some real pop shots at mom, you know, but it was something else to watch.
Well, that's really an amazing result. I mean, if someone had come in to our office presenting a case where the doctor had made the case that they were trying to save the baby's life, concerned about a placental abruption, you know, I think our initial instinct would be, gosh, that's probably not a case we would want to do. It's a very hard case. So, I mean, getting that result. As you talk through it, though, it now seems like I can understand why it would have that appeal. And seems like that issue of the bleeding played into the cover-up issue, because I mean, that's like the 10,000-pound gorilla issue. It's hard to get over that. I mean, if they're lying about that, then it's a cover-up, right?
They actually said in their closing, the plaintiffs want you to believe this is a conspiracy, a cover-up. And I couldn't believe that they said it, because we got to stand up at that point and say, conspiracy? Conspiracy? Did you hear me say the word conspiracy? That was them who brought up conspiracy. Do you think they have something to hide? I didn't say conspiracy, but now I've said it 15 times. You know, but that was, there's all sorts of blunders. Like, but that's what I'm telling you, man. You never know how the ball's going to bounce, right? Yeah. That one bounced into my hand. I was like, okay, thanks.
Well, the ball bounced into your hand again right after that in your Philadelphia trial. You want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so I beelined it out after closing arguments from Baltimore County. I got a call from John the next day that we had a question from the jury. And I asked him, you know, because I was preparing for the next one in Philadelphia. And I said, well, what was the question? And he goes, the question is, can we have a calculator?
Oh, wow.
And I did this kind of karate kick. It was all by myself in my house in my sweatpants preparing for trial. And I did like this karate kick. And I got a little over aggressive. And I think I pulled every muscle in my hip. So 4 days later, I'm limping into court to give opening statement in the other birth injury case. That was a case tried against the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. It was a no offer case up until the very end of the case. And we touched on an interesting thing earlier. And Raul, I'm sure you got this, but you know, when the Inner Circle asked questions of interviews, I thought the most poignant question that was asked of me, I think it was by Rick Friedman, was, he goes, I don't care how much money you've won. He goes, tell me the most money you've walked away from and kept going. And I knew the answer right off the top of my head, because everybody knows that answer, because when you walk away from significant 7-8 figure sums and keep going, that will give you a little bit of a pucker factor. You know, yeah, that will tend to stick out in your brain. You will remember those details. I found that very interesting, that that's what he thought. How much money did you walk away from? And from that, I've really developed is you got to have the chutzpah to walk away from big money. You got to, now, and a lot of times it's your clients, you have to advise them. And look, there's risk that comes with that. It's easy to always do the conservative, safe thing. And we think we do the conservative, safe thing, but we're just trying to maximize the value of the case. But ultimately, it always comes down to someone's going to have hindsight at the end of this thing, because that jury, you know, there's no participation trophy. You either win or you lose. So when we walked into the case, the hospital, University of Pennsylvania, again, hard-fought case, tough on the medicine. Our client was fantastic. And again, I think it really went down to if the defense had kept it simple and focused on their main theme instead of fighting us on everything, it would have come out a lot better. Life expectancy was a big issue in the case. I mean, everybody knew what we were forecasting when we walked into that trial. They'd known for years that if that child lived to normal life expectancy, he'd have over $100 million in future medical cost. Everybody knew that. So when we went into the trial and they said, well, he's catastrophically injured, but he's only going to live 3 years. They were putting up numbers of $2 million. We're putting up numbers of $100 million. Now, that's a big stretch for the jury, right? And instead of just hammering down, the defense kind of went and attacked everything, attacked the plaintiff, attacked this, attacked that. Everybody did everything right. We always do everything right. Very off-putting type of testimony. And the optics weren't right. I mean, we're in inner city Philadelphia. We have a predominantly minority jury in this case. The hospital, University of Pennsylvania, came in and tried it on how prestigious they are and how well-educated their doctors are and how they are the cream of the crop and they don't make mistakes. I mean, I asked one woman, I'm like, you tell me you just never make mistakes? Never make mistakes. I'm like, you drive a car? Yeah, I drive a car. So you ever run a red light? She looks at the jury and says, no. Nobody believes that. Everybody runs a red light. Everybody, like that's it. She lied. The whole case boiled down that you could see them afterwards, like throw down their pens because she wouldn't admit to having simple faults. Again, it's one of those things where you just keep going. The case should have settled. Somebody should have seen what was happening. I saw what was happening. John saw what was happening. My partner Merritt saw what was happening. And we're like, what are we going to do? Like, we're going to keep going.
This is a good case of corporate inability to react and adjust. I thought that towards the end of that trial that those lawyers really wanted to come to some resolution. And I thought in the end it was their client's inability to assimilate that information and come up with different assessments of the case, because they had to go to committee and other committees and larger committees.
Yeah, the institution, they couldn't turn the ship fast enough. And it allowed us to get a case. I mean, look, you guys know how it goes. I mean, it's so hard now to get a case to trial between all the COVID postponements and our civil servants not wanting to put in the hard work and the expenses. And now we've got Daubert motions and evidentiary motions in every case. Cases getting kicked out for the other thing. Just getting to trial is hard. You know, but once you're there, it's winning it is even harder. You know, these MedMal cases, I mean, they're tough. They're like, I think in the world of personal injury, they're probably the toughest cases there are. They're like the antitrust of litigation, personal injury litigation. You're trading wits with neurosurgeons and MFMs and fellows, and you know, talking to somebody about who ran the red light, even though sometimes that helps.
I want to add to that a little bit. One of the things that I thought Briggs did a good job of, and I think we all did, is we created a visible contrast between us and the defense. I'm going to give you one example, and there are many examples in different shapes, but one that really stands out for me is our crosses and our directs are crisp to the point and short. Theirs, or I mean, I wanted to put a bullet in my head. That's how boring.
Ours.
And we let them do that on purpose. And it was like, you could see the jury wake up, listen, take notes when we were up, and then just back to sleep when they stood up. And we let them do that. And we let them do it, and we encouraged them to do it.
And that's another thing, Ben, like with, I'm sure you do this when you put on your experts, you know, we have this natural tendency to let me show the jury how fancy and shiny this expert is and talk about his CV. Let's do a 40-minute voir dire. We got away from all of that. We're like, you know, are you a doctor? Yes. What type of doctor are you? I'm an OB. How long have you been practicing? 30 years. How many babies have you delivered? 10,000. Are you familiar with all the issues in this case? Yes, I am. Your Honor, I move to qualify them. Like, that's our voir dire. I mean, and then let the defense get up and say, well, do you have experience with this? They're not going to do it. They're going to say, okay, he's an expert. And then you do it. But you don't bore the jury with 40 minutes and put them to sleep before you get to the substance of your case. And unless you short skirt voir dire, you're going to lose their attention. You have to limit voir dire because you need to get into the meat of your testimony before you lose that juror's attention in a half an hour. We really focus, and that's something, again, that I've learned as just trying cases. The more streamlined you are, the faster you are, the more to the point. I mean, that juries really appreciate that. Plain speak.
The other big thing in that case I thought was, I always smile when the defense comes back with some esoteric defense that's nowhere documented in the medical record. Some people get scared. Oh, my God, how am I going to address them? It's like a gift. In this particular case, and we've got a bunch of them where they did this, they come up with this esoteric defense of fetal inflammatory response syndrome, which is sort of not very well known, primarily studied in premature babies phenomenon that has discrete markers, right? It's not something that occurs frequently at all. And that was their defense. And their expert reports had first fetal inflammatory response syndrome mentioned in two pages. Briggs, what was it, like 30 times by one expert?
Yeah, 27 times by their infectious disease expert, wasn't mentioned one time in 7,000 pages of medical records.
Not one time. The Cross Rights itself, SHOP, one of the best hospitals in the world, one of the best hospitals for children, also in Philadelphia. Some of the most brilliant minds working there in pediatrics and neonatology, they don't know what FERS is, but you do, sir, at $800 an hour.
I remember the discussion of that issue, and it seemed like a pretty good gift for you that... And just remind me, what's the brief summary of that case so our folks know what the facts were of that?
Is that the Higgins case, John?
Yeah.
I mean, brief summary is you had a full-term mom who was developing chorioamnioitis, comes into the hospital, the strip, fetal monitoring strip, starts showing major problems. The plan was to deliver the baby, monitor the strip, but then deliver the baby if the strip did not improve. And then hours went by. And finally, there was an emergency C-section. The baby came out in distress, and the rest is history. The case boiled down to they needed to intervene within those 2 hours. They had a time that this injury was completely avoidable. You have to tell this jury that the hardest thing about these cases, when they see these horribly, horribly touched little children that are just breaks your heart. I mean, it absolutely breaks your heart. They sit there and you talk about life expectancy with them. You talk about all of these different things. But ultimately, it's a very, well, I'm sorry, I lost my kind of train of thought there, guys. But I've got to kind of jump here for another. I got someone bugging me they've been blowing up my computer on the other side here, saying you're late for mediation. So I apologize. I trailed off.
We're pushing up against our hour time limit anyway, but.
I trailed off up there. But listen, the kids drive these cases. And in that case, the biggest colossal mistake I think they made was they brought on this expert by video to say this child was a vegetable. He didn't feel pain. He didn't recognize his mother. All of these things that, and, you know, my client's got tears running down her eyes. And so we bring the child in. And I have one of her brothers carry the child in. And I said, when he comes in, say hi to him. And she's up on the witness stand. And the child gets brought in and says hi. And kid perks right up, looks like looking around, like, where's mom? Where's mom? Yeah, you know, like, he's not a vegetable. I was like, look at this. Like, look what they're trying to pull, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that kind of stuff. And again, that's a fortuitous, that's a gift. You know, there was no reason to do it. Absolutely no reason to say that stuff. You want to say he's going to die early. Okay, I understand that. I get that defense. But don't say in the interim that he's a vegetable. So he can't feel any pain, so he doesn't deserve a pain and suffering award when an injury was 100% completely avoidable.
So I guess the moral of the story here is when you got a defendant in a birth injury case trying to fight you on multiple fronts, don't resist them. Let them. I mean, because typically it results in a very poor appearance and for them and lack of credibility because they can't pick their issues and you got to let them do it.
And life expectancy is a hard issue. It takes a real savvy defense lawyer to stand up there and say, we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't cause anything. But if we did, we cause such devastation that this child's not going to live that long. So really, under the law, you shouldn't give him much money. That's a tough argument to make. And I think it takes a very skilled and very compassionate defense lawyer to make that. But no matter who makes it, no matter how compassionate they are, you can turn it around and use it as, it's almost ghoulish.
I've never seen it happen. I've never seen anyone do it effectively on the other side. I don't think you can win that argument. And I think you're better off not making it. But who am I to say?
Well, guys, thanks so much for joining us. I know we're pressing up against our hour time limit here, but we really appreciate it. I learned a lot from hearing from you guys. And
this was amazing.
Yeah.
You guys are both amazing. So congratulations on all your success.
Oh, I just want to say this before you let us go. I'm a big fan. I've been listening to the two of you for a while now. I keep doing what you're doing. It's fantastic for lawyers, especially busy lawyers who can't take an afternoon to read David Ball. You know, we rely on people like you and your podcast to learn and stay up to date. So thank you.
And I would just like to say, for your audience at large, you know, both these guys being Inner Circle members and young members of the Inner Circle at that, Raul, congratulations. I mean, that is my career achievement. It's the thing I'm probably most proud of in the legal worlds. And like Ben said, it's a group of amazingly talented, but humble, hardworking people. And I think you'll fit right in. So I'm looking forward to getting to know you better at the formal bar.
No, really looking forward to it. And thank you. And I'm just glad to be a part of you guys.
Oh, by the way, drinks are always on the new guy.
You're assuming his induction speech goes well, but, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Whatever you do, do not screw up that speech. They will judge you on that.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. No, that's nerve-wracking. That's the speech of your life. Don't mess it up. No pressure.
On that note, thank you. No, I'm kidding. Thanks so much, guys. It's great seeing you both.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.